morning is Co-Chairman Green, Vice Chairman Ogan, Representative John Davies, Senator Taylor's Chief of Staff Joe Ambrose, Senator Miller, and Representative Gail Davis, the Speaker of House, Representative. Gail Phillips, I'm sorry. Madam Speaker.
It's all right, Mr. Chairman.
And we also have with us Mr. Jim Ayers, the Governor's Knowles Chief of Staff. First, I'd like to welcome all of you to this special meeting and thank you for taking the time on Saturday morning to come together to help us find solutions to the problems facing our communities. As you know, our focus this morning is on the forest products industry, and particularly on the timber supply problem, which has already resulted in the loss of many jobs. We recognize that there are many different interests and user groups in the Tongass National Forest, but we also know that the timber industry makes up a large part of the economy here in Southeast. We have invited various panelists here today to help the community, this committee to learn more about the problems and hopefully hear how we might help to find solutions. We want to hear ideas from different points of view that are represented on these panels. The chair hopes that by listening to you and asking some questions, all of us have come here to listen may better be able to find solutions to the problems facing our timber-dependent communities in Southeast Alaska. Five different panels will be presenting testimony today. They are independent operators coordinated by Cliff Phillips, Cliff Skillings. I'm really good on the names this morning.
Just off by one.
The long-term timber contract led by KPC President Ralph Lewis, the grassroots community panel, including representatives from SEAC and Stand Up. I did also invite Tongass Conservation Society, but they had other commitments. And the community leadership panel, including representatives from Craig, Wrangell, Ketchikan, along with the Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce. We are also pleased to have here with us today the regional forester Phil Janik and some of his fine staff. As each of these panels come forward to give testimony, we will ask the members to identify themselves for the record. Now, to begin our meeting this morning, I would like to have everybody view with me an excellent slide presentation which has been put together by the U.S. Forest Service that provides a good history and land use in the Tongass National Forest.
Water, wilderness, wildlife, and fish. Sometimes balancing the use of these resources is difficult at best, and we depend on public understanding to help us make decisions about natural resources. Today we want to talk specifically about one of those resources, timber. We'd like to discuss forested land in the Tongass National Forest. Now the area which provides timber for the consumer has changed over time. We'll show you a series of photographs, maps, and graphs, and talk about how certain events which have occurred since World War II affect the overall management of the forest. Relatively few people are aware of the significant changes in forest land availability in the Tongass. The Tongass National Forest was established in 1907. At that time, it contained about 11 million forested acres. However, not all forested land is suited to timber management. About 4.6 million acres of the Tongass grow trees, but not of a quality which can be used for wood products. For example, short pines growing in muskeg areas are not suitable for timber production. This leaves about 6.4 million acres of productive forest land. Our first map shows all the forested land in the current Tongass in green. The most productive timberlands are dark green. The magenta color represents the Southeast Alaska town withdrawals and Annette Island Indian Reservation. Note the bar graph in the lower left corner that shows the potential commercial forest land. A close-up of the bar graph shows the 6.4 million acres of productive forest land. During the early years of the Tongass National Forest, there were few people and limited use of the land. Over time, both the population and the uses of the land have increased. After World War II, the people and elected officials of the Territory of Alaska and the Forest Service saw natural resource industry development as a way to provide year-round jobs to support the communities of Southeast Alaska. The federal government, territorial government, and many people in Southeast Alaska saw development as a primary way to provide these jobs. After World War II, timber activity started to expand when the Forest Service awarded two 50-year contracts to Ketchikan Pulp and Paper Company and Alaska Lumber and Pulp Company. At that time, there were about 6.4 million acres of commercial forest land in the Tongass. However, as a result of environmental and other multiple use considerations, not all of these acres were scheduled for harvest. The amount of available commercial forest land began to change when Alaska became a state in 1959. At that time, the state was allowed to select and take title to 400,000 acres of national forest land in the Chugach and the Tongass National Forests. As a result of these selections, about 165,000 acres of commercial forest land in the Tongass have been transferred to the state. Ultimately, many of these lands have passed into private ownership, like the city of Thorne Bay. The magenta color shows the total Tongass land transferred to the state. These selections reduce the available commercial forest land in the Tongass by about 200,000 acres. A close-up of this bar graph shows the effects of the 200,000 acre reduction. In 1971, Congress passed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Each of the Native corporations established at that time were allowed to select federal lands near their communities and near villages such as Klawak. These lands were transferred to private ownership. The Native corporations selected about 460,000 acres of commercial forest land within the Tongass. An objective of the corporations was to return a profit to their shareholders. Therefore, much of what they selected was high-quality, timber-producing land. The magenta color on this map shows the total land selected by Native corporations, which reduced the commercial forest land in the Tongass from 6.2 million acres to 5.7 million acres. This graph shows the continued effects of the reduced commercial forest land available for harvest. At the same time, people's expectation for the Forest Service to provide timber to the consumer did not change. In 1980, Congress passed the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, which designated wilderness in the Tongass and reduced the available commercial forest land. In this legislation, most of the wilderness areas recommended in the Tongass Land Management Plan were permanently withdrawn from timber harvest. This included the Admiralty Island and Misty Fjords National Monuments. The magenta color on this map highlights these wilderness areas and national monuments and shows that the availability of commercial forest land in the Tongass has been reduced by about 1.6 million acres. The available commercial forest land has now gone from just under 6 million acres before the ANILCA legislation to about 4.1 million acres. The bar graph on map 4 depicts this change. Again, many people's expectation for the Forest Service to provide wood products did not change. In 1990, the Tongass Timber Reform Act, or TTRA, was passed. Shown here is a stream buffer. This act made about 700,000 acres of commercial forest land unavailable because these acres were included in new wilderness areas, additional stream buffers, and other protected categories. On this map, the spidery magenta-colored lines mark some of the stream buffers. The magenta color on this map shows the 700,000 acres of commercial forest land, as well as unproductive and non-forested land. The available timber base has now been reduced from 4.1 million to 3.4 million acres. This graph shows a reduction to 3.4 million acres as a result result of legislative action. Not all of the 3.4 million acres of commercial forest land remaining after land selections and legislative withdrawals are available for timber harvest. The Forest Service is a multiple-use agency and considers all resources in their planning efforts. In 1979, the Forest Service prepared the Tongass Land Management Plan and identified, with the help of the public, a number of opportunities, including timber production, to pursue for the next 10 years. Many of these opportunities, such as wildlife habitat and scenic management, limit timber harvest. During the planning process, the Forest Service identified unsuitable commercial forest land. These were lands with environmental conditions that rule out logging. For example, land with steep slopes, poor soils, and poor regeneration potential. Land managers also identified commercial forest land to be considered for other multiple uses not compatible with timber management. These forest lands meet multiple use objectives, such as old growth habitat protection, primitive recreation areas, and other purposes. Also, administratively withdrawn from the commercial forest land base during the planning process were lands to be managed in a roadless state to retain their wildland characteristics. These land use designation 2, or LUD 2 areas, are shown here in the magenta color. Currently, the forest plan is being revised. The Forest Service estimates, according to the revision, that 1.7 million acres of commercial forest land are unsuitable for timber management or have multiple use objectives that are not compatible with timber management. This close-up of the bar graph on map 6 shows the effects that consideration of other resources as well as inoperable acres have had on the commercial forest land. So what has happened to the available commercial forest land in the Tongass National Forest since World War II? Because of legislative and administrative action to emphasize all resources, including timber management, it has gone from 6.4 million acres to 1.7 million acres. Let's take a look at map 1 again and compare the original commercial forest land shown here in green to the current situation of available commercial forest land in the Tongass National Forest. This graph again shows that over time, there has been a significant reduction in the amount of commercial forest land available for timber production. The legislative action that has occurred and the planning decisions that were made in response to environmental conditions and to meet other multiple use objectives have reduced the original 6.4 million acres to 1.7 million acres scheduled for timber harvest over the next 100 to 150 years. There are those who still expect the Forest Service to manage today's 1.7 million acres of scheduled commercial forest land as if it were the 6.4 million acres available when the Tongass was established in 1907. Since the amount of available commercial forest land has changed significantly, it is becoming more difficult to meet everyone's expectations. The public has also become more concerned about the manner in which timber is harvested on the national forest. In conclusion, each of the changes we have described on the preceding maps has increasingly reduced the commercial forest lands from which the Forest Service can make timber available. By themselves, each of these changes has had some impact, but together, they have greatly reduced the available commercial forest lands from when the timber program began in the years after World War II. Because of all the demands being placed on the national forests, including the demands for wood, it is becoming more and more difficult to satisfy everyone's expectations.
Now, if we could get the lights back on. I think that was a very good presentation this morning to start off this meeting with. Now, before we ask our first panel to come forward, I'd like to give our special guests an opportunity to say a few words. I'd first like to yield the floor to the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Gail Phillips from Homer. Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's great to be here today with everybody. It's great to see many of your constituents here and many friends here, and I thank everybody for turning out. And I also would like to thank Representative Williams for the work he did to put together this meeting. I think it is a crucial time that the House Resource Committee meet in Ketchikan, and I'm very pleased that, Mr. Chairman, that you have taken this effort. When Representative Williams came to me and asked me if we could have a meeting down here, I said on one condition, that I be allowed to come to the meeting also. Because I think it's very, very important that the people in this area of Alaska recognize and realize the fact that the House of Representatives is committed to working towards economic security for the people of Southeast Alaska. And I just want to make sure that everybody, that we're all on the same track there. Mr. Chairman, we have seen this film, and we have seen what has happened to the forests of Southeast Alaska over the years. And I just have one comment to make. Certainly with the economic crisis we are experiencing in this region of Alaska, with the mills that are closed down, anybody that is coming out with a statement that 320 million board feet is enough for us to utilize here is not looking at the economic reality of this area of Alaska and what this means to the state of Alaska. And where you need our support, where you need my support, I am certainly there for whatever you're going to need. We are taking a few small steps in the House of Representatives right now to correct the measure. Representative Williams introduced new legislation, House Bill 121, a very small little forest bill. It's called Salvage Timber Bill. I come from the Kenai Peninsula. On the Kenai Peninsula, we have our forests are absolutely devastated with a spruce beetle infestation. This bill will allow us to move up the schedule of timber sales on those devastated forests. It's just a small step, and yet the hue and outcry from people that think that the forests are better off untended and untaken care of and unproduced is just amazing to me. I read an article yesterday where Washington State is in the process of revamping their entire Forest Practices Act entirely. And the flack we take over one little bill for dead trees is just amazing. I don't know a lot about your industry, Mr. Chairman. I'm just a gold miner. But I know that as Alaskans, if we don't stand together strong to fight for our responsibility to develop our resources in Alaska, we are going to lose the economic viability of our state. And I also want everybody to know when you come into my office and sign the guest book, you are going to be facing a sign that reads, without production, there is no economy. And without economy, civilizations fail. Mr. Chairman, I'm not about to let our civilization in Alaska fail. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Next, we have Joe Ambrose for Senator Taylor.
Chairman, thank you. Senator Taylor offers his apologies for not being here today. He had a death in the family and had to go back to the Midwest. He has asked me to make some remarks that reflect his feelings on this issue. And I might add as a personal note, I'm a 20-year resident of Ketchikan, and they definitely reflect my own. A great deal of what's going on here is a matter of credibility and trust. When Dole's administration's change in position on the habitat conservation areas became public, the governor's chief of staff asked Lou Williams from the Ketchikan Daily News if he thought that the Knowles administration could trust the Forest Service. There's a pattern that's happening here. The Fish and Wildlife Service announced on Thursday that they had no scientific basis for establishing habitat conservation areas for the wolf. But they also revealed that there's been an agreement in existence since December between the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that ultimately achieves their ends anyway. The Clinton budget, as it was released, shows a reduction for timber harvest based on the establishment of habitat conservation areas. These are the habitat conservation areas that we have been told no final decision has been made on. Well, credibility factors right there. When the president established his forest plan for the Pacific Northwest, it took 85% of the land base out of harvest. Film you just saw. Congressional withdrawals removed 38% of what was available in the Tongass. Other actions took that up to 63%. If you add the 21% under the proposed habitat conservation areas, we come to 84%. That's within one percentage point of what the president has proposed for the Pacific Northwest. I don't think that's a coincidence. I can only believe it's a concerted effort, and what remains will not sustain the economy of this area. Mr. Janik told the governor that they would make available 320 million board feet in the coming year. We know that's not adequate to open the mill in Wrangell, and barely keeps the pipeline going here. That's make available. That doesn't mean that it's not going to be challenged, and the timber supply will be further reduced by those challenges. This area is in a crisis, and folks need to know that, at least from the standpoint of Senator Taylor's office, and frankly from my own personal viewpoint, the agencies that we're dealing with are being less than candid. We've asked on several occasions if the Forest Service or the agencies looking for the goshawk have looked in established wilderness areas. From the top, we are assured they are. You go down a couple notches and talk to somebody that's actually doing the work, and they say, no, we don't have the budget for that. We're looking in areas that we're doing timber surveys on to prepare for harvest. We don't know what the story is, but hopefully meetings like this will bring it out. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Joe. I would like to introduce Senator Mike Miller of North Pole. Senator Miller served as chairman of the Senate Resources Committee in the 18th legislature and is currently chairman of the Senate Rules Committee. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to say it's good to be back in Ketchikan. I spent quite a bit of time here last summer during the campaign, and I really enjoyed it. And during that time, I was able to get a handle of some of the issues that we're facing Southeast Alaska and some of those issues that we're facing you folks here in the Ketchikan area, and especially some of the timber issues. Many of us in the interior Alaska would also like to start a timber industry in interior Alaska with some of the forest lands that we have up there. A little bit different dynamics up there. We're dealing more with state lands versus federal lands. Your trees are considerably bigger than our trees. That's another difference. But there are still many of us that would like to get a timber industry started in interior Alaska. And I think many of the things that we can learn here we can apply to interior Alaska to get those things going. But also, like Gail, we need a strong economy statewide in order to make everything work. We need, not only in my opinion, a strong timber economy, we need a strong mining economy. We need a strong fishing economy. We need a strong a tourism economy. We need, because they all work together in order to make a strong economy for Alaska so that Alaskans can have a good living. And it'll be a place that that our kids want to stay here. I was born in the state of Alaska. I intend to stay in the state of Alaska, but I want to make sure that there are jobs so that my kids, should they decide to stay in the state of Alaska, could also stay in the state of Alaska and make a living. So I think that's what part of our goal is to do, to create a strong economy, and I think timber is one of those areas where we can have a strong economy, but we're going to have to work hard for it, quite frankly, I'm somewhat biased in this position, but I'm pro-timber. That's where I'm at on the issues, and I will continue to be. I think we need to develop our timber economy, and I will do whatever I can in my position in the state Senate to do that. And I thank the chairman for inviting me down here, so I can continue to stay involved in these issues, and I appreciate that fact, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And last but not least, we have someone who is not a stranger to this area, Mr. Jim Ayers, who's the Chief of Staff for Governor Knowles. Mr. Ayers, would you like to say a few words?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity, the Governor appreciates your invitation, certainly that the legislature and your committee has taken the time to meet outside of, you know, that realm, as we all know, gets pretty close sometimes, pretty nearsighted, so I appreciate actually being back in Ketchikan, where I worked for number of years, and have appreciated also listening to people, at least the previous speakers, talk about a strong, sustainable economy. And certainly that's what the governor talked about during the campaign, as did Senator Miller, and many of the other people at this table. I think that really is the essence of the issue, is how do we build a strong and sustainable economy? The governor is committed to the jobs and families. I mean, that's what he ran on, and that's what he's concerned about. That's why I'm here today. I hope that we can get to the point where we can talk about it together, about how do we get to sustainable, how we figure out how to get to a T-lump that's a meaningful process that includes the communities, meaningful information, concerned people like those of us at this table and those in this room, and that we figure out a way to have it be sustainable. A sustainable fishing industry, a sustainable timber industry. We're going to cut some timber, and we need to focus on that. We know that there's going to be a tourism industry. There's some 4,000 jobs in the southeast about that. We also know that we need to work together to get that done. That if we go to scapegoating, we watched what happened in the Northwest, where there was simply warfare. We got in, there was total denial, and they got to spot it out. Our major focus, Joe brought up, we're trying to figure out how to avoid the spotted out question in Alaska and get to a strong, sustainable economy. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Ayers. Before we get started here, what I'd like to do is open up the Bay Areas a little bit more. I'll take time off right now and wait for... are you going to open any more, Pete?
Can we open this?
Yeah. Did you want to open this? Were you going to open this any more than it is now?
We can open it a little more.
I will wait for you. I'd like to call the meeting back to order. Before we ask the first panel to come and give testimony, I'd like to set forth some ground rules. We have a very severe time constraint this morning, so I ask that all of you try to give me your cooperation. Each panel has been allotted limited time. My committee aide, Jack Phelps, will be displaying time cards to each of you to let you know how much time you have left. Please honor the limits and end your testimony as quickly as possible when your time is up. I would also ask my fellow committee members and special guests to write down any questions you might have and ask them, the panelists, during the question and answer time at the end of at the end. Please allow the panel their full time to give their testimony. Finally, I would ask that during the question and answer period, you direct the questions through the chair, and please keep your questions very brief so that the committee members can other committee members can have an opportunity to ask their questions. The answers are going to be limited to 2 minutes. We'll first start with the first panel, the independent operators, Cliff Skillings. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Cliff Skillings, Alaska Women's Association.
Steve Seeley, Seaborn Lumber.
Kurt Dahlstrom, Viking Lumber.
Frank Hayes, Pacific Rim Cedar.
When you're giving your testimony also, please state your name.
My name is Cliff Skillings with the Alaska Lumbermen's Association. I'm giving the introduction for the Independent Timber Operators panel this morning. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the House Natural Resources Committee, Committee Chair Williams, Committee Chair Green, and distinguished guests for allowing me a moment to express to you the concerns of the Small Business Administration timber industry and its respectful federal timber sale program. I couldn't help but notice the fine wood products that were used this morning to support picket signs. I'm pleased to know that this form of sign support will not melt in the rain. The Alaska Lumbermen's Association is an organization of small business administration timber operators and Southeast Alaskan businesses and individuals who wish to see a productive and viable SBA timber sale program on the Tongass. I have with me this morning Steve Seeley, owner and president of Seaborn Lumber Company in Ketchikan, Frank Age, owner and president of Pacific Rim Cedar and Wrangell, and Kirk Dahlstrom, owner and president of Viking Lumber, which currently owns and operates the Klawock Sawmill. I would ask that while you listen to their testimony this morning, you remember just two aspects about our industry and respectful timber sale program. The 80 million board foot demand that you will hear this morning is a real demand by the SBA timber industry. 80 million board feet is an attainable target volume to subside this industry, agreed upon by both SBA and Forest Service two decades ago. It is a volume that is processable by our regional SBA sawmills, and it represents an integral part of the entire Southeast Alaska timber industry. And two, HCA legislation is a regulatory action which has a devastating trickle-down effect upon the SBA timber operators on the Tongass. HCA's first deplete the timber harvest base from both the long-term contract holder and the SBA independent timber operators. HCA's are causing a significant impact to the timber industry by deferring and canceling timber sales in both sale programs. In so removing certain sales from both programs, the SBA timber industry is affected the hardest when the Forest Service must remove prepared timber sales from our sale program and release them to long-term contract holders to meet the contractual obligations. This is simply not fair, especially when the sales are removed from the Ketchikan and Prince Wales vicinity and any replacement volume is located in the northern Chatham region. With these in mind, I would like to introduce Steve Seeley, Jr., owner and president of Seaborn Lumber Company.
I'd like to thank Chairman Williams and Green and the House Natural Resources for holding this public forum and allowing me the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Small Business Administration timber operators on the Tongass. My name is Steve Seeley, Jr., owner and president of Seaborn Lumber in Ketchikan, Alaska. Seaborn Lumber currently maintains a sawmill operation in Ketchikan. I have spent 40 years of my life in southeastern Alaska and primarily the Prince Wales Island and Ketchikan communities. I grew up on Prince Wales Island in a timber harvesting family. In 1978, I established Seeley Incorporated. This company grew from a four-man jupo operation to a multifaceted timber business involving road construction, high lead logging, marine transportation, whole log chipping, and sawmill operations. 1993, with the promise of a guaranteed timber supply from federal government SBA timber sale program, I began the construction of sawmill facility, now operated as Seaborn Lumber Company. The SBA timber sale program was designed in 1973 to ensure that regional small business timber operators would have a supply of timber to meet the demand of their processing facilities, eliminating larger corporate intervention. This concept was formalized in agreement entered into on March 18, 1977, between SBA representative Art Mason and then regional forester John Sandor, and was called the Agreement Between Department of Agriculture and the Small Business Administration for the Development and Operation of a Small Business Program and the Sale of National Forest Timber-Related Products. This marked the beginning of the SBA version of a long-term timber sale contract. This agreement stated that the Forest Service and Small Business Administration have agreed to set aside program of approximately 80 million board feet of saw timber for the Tongass. In 1986, this agreement was amended to cause the Forest Service to follow closer the target volume of 80 million board feet, especially since the entire industry had just witnessed depressed timber volumes in the previous 1984 and 85 timber sale years. It was again amended in 1993 due to two SBA mill shutdowns, Mitkoff Lumber in Haines and Klawock Timber in Klawock, at which point the U.S. Forest Service stated that they felt demand was significantly lower than the target volume of 80 million board feet. The new amendment called for cyclical six-month meetings between U.S. Forest Service and SBA representatives to identify mill capacity and meet SBA demand. To my knowledge, these meetings have never involved regional SBA timber operators, and the 80 million board foot demand still has not been met. With these agreements and legislative wording placed in the Tongass Timber Reform Act of 1990 to help support SBA timber operators, I proceeded to build a new sawmill facility to process timber harvested from the Tongass National Forest. Seaborn Lumber now employs 31 loggers, 54 mill workers. Our sister company, Seaborn Marine Service, employs an additional 20 men and women. Our sawmill processes raw timber into cants, flitches, squares, and produces chips from residual slabs and low-quality logs. Today, my primary concern lies with the current supply of SBA timber and the fact that the fiscal year 1995 timber sales schedule falls short of meeting U.S. Forest Service commitment to the Small Business Administration and those of us who depend on that supply of timber. Seaborn Lumber has an annual sawmill demand of 26 million board feet. In addition, we have the capacity to chip 11.5 million feet for a total need of 37.5 million board feet of timber. Seaborn Lumber's operations have been severely affected over the course of 1994 due to a log supply shortage brought on as a result of extreme pressure from environmental groups striving to curtail a harvest of timber on the Tongass. The Forest Service lack of desire or inability or lack of funding necessary to combat this pressure has resulted in a shortfall in meeting the SBA industry demand for logs. Habitat conservation areas have posed the biggest threat to the SBA timber supply due to their impacts on the entire industry. Harvest areas have been deferred, even though they have passed all NEPA gates, have been funded for the entire preparation period of 2 to 4 years, and are ready for immediate advertisement. HCAs have further posed a problem for our industry in the fact that when harvest areas are deferred or withheld from the long-term contract holder, the Forest Service will remove timber sales from the SBA and independent pipeline to meet the long-term sale contractual obligations and then not replace that volume. Today, the SBA pipeline is nearly empty. Let me give you an example of my company's need for timber. On December 1st of 1994, we cut the last log in our yard and curtailed our sawing operations. The Bushy Island salvage sale was bid on December 28, 1995. We were the successful bidder of six companies competing for the sale containing approximately 400,000 board feet of timber. The sale was awarded 1 week after the bid opening. 2 days later, we had cutters on the island. 3 days after that, we'd mobilized a camp and equipment to the site. 31 days from the date of the bid opening, we had harvested the entire volume and all equipment and logs were removed from the sale area and delivered to Ketchikan. Unfortunately, the timber volume from this sale will provide only 3.7 days of cutting at our mill. Seaborn Lumber has invested $1.4 million in 1994 to upgrade our facility, allowing us to expand our product line with higher valued lumber. These improvements include the latest technology and computerized set works to ensure accurate sizing, new carriage and drive system capable of operating 3 times faster than the equipment it replaced, helping reduce manufacture cost at that machinery center. An edger with both shifting and gang saws that provide for efficient breakdown of cants to a multitude of semi-finished products. And a new trim station with capability to accurately even and trim all lumber that is produced. In addition to the sawmill equipment, we designed and built a drum chipping system that will take a defective log end of any diameter up to 6 feet in length and cut it to chips acceptable for sale to Ketchikan Pulp Company, helping meet their fiber needs. Each machinery center not only adds to our flexibility and profitability, they also add jobs to the community. The SBA timber industry is not restricted to certain sales, as the Forest Service may think. They have stated that the SBA industry does not have the capability to process the volume needed to meet the 50% SBA primary processing clause placed on all SBA timber sales. Currently, Seaborn and Viking Lumber have chipping capabilities along with cutting facilities that ensure the 50% timber processing clause can be met by SBA-owned companies. The Forest Service has stated that the SBA operators cannot locate adequate funding to cover the cost of performance bonds, pre-roading, and harvest costs for larger sales. As a matter of fact, regional financial institutions such as National Bank of Alaska and First Bank stand ready to assist SBA timber operators with their financial needs. Finally, the Forest Service has stated that smaller operators will have a harder time finding or creating markets for their products. To answer these, I can only say that the majority, if not all, SBA mills have contracts with one or several purchasers for the products that we produce. So you see, there's a viable and striving SBA timber industry in Southeast Alaska. Our industry adds to community socioeconomic levels and provides employment for many Southeastern Alaska residents. Level of timber the U.S. Forest Service plans to offer the SBA timber operators over the next 2 years falls short of meeting the SBA processing capacity. The volumes for both years as currently planned will fail to meet the 80 million board feet promise that we so desperately seek. If the three mills at this panel, if operated at full production levels, have the capacity to cut all 80 million board feet. However, there are 36 smaller SBA classified processing facilities in Southeast Alaska who also seek to share the federal timber sale program allotment. It is imperative that the U.S. Forest Service adhere to 80 million board foot yearly target volume so as to maintain the viability of our sector of the industry. We have demonstrated our ability to survive and at the same time pay the highest average stumpage prices and continually upgrade and improve our manufacturer capability to meet the market demand for a variety of products. Coupled with this 80 million board foot demand should come timeliness of SBA timber sale offerings, sale areas located geographically equal to the total volume sold off the Tongass, and timber sales that are economically viable, for without these demands met, the SBA timber industry and supporting operators will surely be eliminated. Thank you for the opportunity to share my concerns regarding the SBA timber sale program with you this morning.
I would like to thank the committee chairmen, William and Green, and other panel members for this opportunity to present the concerns that surround our Small Business Administration timber sale program on the Tongass National Forest. My name is Frank Age. I am the owner and president of Pacific Rim Cedar, which owns and operates a sawmill facility in Wrangell, Alaska. I came to Alaska in 1991 after my Oregon mill was forced to shut down following extensive timber reduction due to spotted owl legislation. I started Age Cedar Products in Wrangell, Alaska with a small mill processing cedar shakes and shingles. I started with 5 employees and operated profitably until the high delivered cost of logs created an uneconomical situation for my mill. In 1993, after reviewing market trends and congressional oversight to provide for an economical supply of timber to regional SBA timber operators, I created Pacific Rim Cedar with the purpose of manufacturing logs from the Tongass into marketable wood products. My employment base has grown since 1991 from 5 employees to 14, encompassing milling, log transportation, sort yard operations. Currently, Pacific Rim Cedar is the only operating sawmill in the township of Wrangell. Over the course of 1994, Pacific Rim Cedar has made numerous upgrades in the attempt to produce a better product for a lower manufactured cost. These upgrades to facility and heavy equipment have cost in excess of $450,000. With these improvements, Pacific Rim Cedar was able to increase productivity approximately 15%. Pacific Rim Cedar milling operations relies heavily on the U.S. Forest Service obligation to provide an economically viable timber supply of 80 million feet for regional SBA timber operations use. Pacific Rim Cedar has a saw log volume capacity of 10 to 12 million feet annually. We are currently cutting spruce and hemlock, but would prefer to be processing western red and Alaska yellow cedar should there be a shift in U.S. Forest Service policy surrounding cedar export provisions. This shift in policy would need to require primary processing of all cedar in regional sawmills. Essentially, the same provisions are found with hemlock and spruce. I think we are all acutely aware of the timber supply problems facing all sawmills in southeast Alaska. Our mill can flourish cutting only cedar, which would leave the spruce and hemlock we are now cutting for other sawmills in the region. However, it is economically unfeasible to process these cedar logs and compete to sell the sawn products produced while cedar logs in their round form of similar quality are allowed to be exported. We must stop the export of cedar in the round and keep these logs at home for manufacture in regional facilities. Over the last 10 years, industry has exported 430 million feet of cedar, or an average of 43 million feet per year. An average mill can process approximately 3.2 thousand feet of lumber per man per day. This represents 13,437 man days of employment exported to other areas each year. Converted to dollars, our Southeast Alaska communities lost $2,526,000 in payroll alone last year. If we continue this process for the next 10 years, the region can expect to lose another $25 million in payroll and other economic benefits to the communities. Pacific Rim Cedar stands able and willing to assist the Forest Service in any way possible to meet the 80 million board feet demand that is required by SBA timber operators and facilities in the Tongass National Forest. We're here to beg the Forest Service to make good on their promise to provide that 80 million board feet required by our industry. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to present my concerns regarding our industry. Thank you.
My name is Kirk Dahlstrom, partner and manager of Viking Lumber Company, which currently owns and operates a sawmill facility outside the town of Kluak, Alaska. Viking Lumber purchased the Kluak sawmill in June of 1994. I'd like to thank the committee for my chance to testify. I thought when I moved to Alaska 8 months ago that my testifying was going to be over. I didn't want to do it anymore. I've been doing it for 5 years in Washington State, trying to fight the spotted owl. My partners and I saw the potential for a thriving processing facility, putting people to work from surrounding communities and raising community economic levels. The whole idea was contingent upon a supply of timber that I presumed would be available due to prior SBA and Forest Service agreements wording added to the TTRA language, which directed the Forest Service to provide a supply of timber that would meet SBA market demand and mill capacity, a supply of 80,000 or 80 million board feet. I should have known better. My partners and I have had an old-growth hemlock sawmill on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State for 17 years, buying, logging, and processing Forest Service timber for the first 13 years. That mill is still running, off and on, because we have learned to survive on scraps and junk for the past 4 years. Because of the lies, the enviros, and the attitude and gutlessness of the Forest Service, the cut on the Olympic National Forest has gone from 239 million board feet per year to 10 million board feet of scraps and junk. This loss of available timber has devastated the community where I was born and raised, forcing me to either become depressed and despondent or move to Alaska, risking everything I own and try again. The small logging communities in Alaska have no idea what will happen to them if the Forest Service does the same thing in Alaska that they did to the Pacific Northwest using the lies about the spotted owls and marbled murrelets. The county I lived in, I was born there, lived there for 41 years, was always a nice community. In the past 4 years, they lost a pulp mill and paper mill with 800 people. They lost 4 sawmills with over 2,000 people. They lost all the trucking, all the logging. The community and all the surrounding small communities have been torn apart now by the haves and have-nots. The haves are the people that have government jobs or work for some few large corporations there. The have-nots are all the independents and the sawmill and pulp mill workers that were there. They try to pass maintenance and repair levies for the schools. The communities that have always stuck together are now fighting, infighting. Neighbors hate each other because some are still working and some are not. And it's going to happen up here. After purchasing the mill and spending $800,000 and 6 months on reconstruction, Viking began operation of the mill 2 months ago in December. Our whole log chipping operation will start operating in April with an investment of over $2 million. These two operations will need 60 to 70 million board feet of timber to run at full production. Our sawmill produces lumber that is truly for value-added products. Every million board feet we produce will put 20 people yearly to work in manufacturing plants, door plants, window plants, and molding plants in the lower 48. The SBA timber sale program was designed to alleviate the apparent one-sidedness that larger timber firms had on the timber industry in the mid-1970s. It was devised by both the SBA and Forest Service that 80 million board feet was an extremely workable and agreeable figure for a timber sale program target for the SBA timber operators. In the process of agreeing that 80 million board feet would be target volume, the SBA representatives and regional forester engaged in a written agreement which ensured that the Forest Service would succeed to meet 80 million board feet for SBA preferential bid. Amendments to this agreement were made in 1986 and 1993, which parallel industry trends to accommodate the industry. A problem has always existed in the Forest Service ability to meet this target volume. A timber crisis was felt extremely hard in 1994 when the Forest Service became incompetent in meeting any SBA timber operator demand. Multiple sales from the Prince of Wales were canceled, deferred, or removed and offered for contractual obligations to the long-term contract holder. Habitat conservation areas are both unwarranted and unnecessary. Wilderness land set aside to preserve massive habitat areas, acres, with the intent being to defer timber harvest in those areas. This further action is blatant preservation actions designed to protect species which are currently not threatened or endangered. Furthermore, this HCA action is being implemented even though it has not been signed into action by the regional forester and did not proceed through any formal TLMP amendment process, and regarded by the Forest Service as non-detrimental to current timber harvest. I guess that when there is no current timber harvest, a federal regulatory agency can say that their actions are non-detrimental to timber harvest. Again, thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, gentlemen, and hopefully we will not try to have the Forest Service cut out our industry in this area. Thank you. We will be hearing next from the long-term timber panel, which will be headed by Troy Reinhardt of KPC. Mr. Reinhardt.
All right.
Good morning. I am going to do the presentation for Ketchikan Polk Company in regards to our long-term contract. I'm Troy Reinhardt. I'm a professional forester that works for Ketchikan Polk. I want to note that we also have with us today in the audience Ralph Lewis, who is our president and general manager, Alan Hayes, who is our pulp mill manager, and Owen Graham, who is our timber manager. And as we get into questions, they would be more than glad to answer those now or any time that you may have those in the future. I want to thank you very much for coming today. It's a pleasure to have you here and talk about this very important subject. Ketchikan Pulp has almost 1,000 employees, consisting of our 5 logging camps, 2 sawmills, and a pulp mill. We sell our products to 20 countries and generate approximately $40 million to the annual payroll. The one thing that has not changed at Ketchikan Pulp in the 4 decades that we've been in this community is our commitment to it. KPC has a partnership with the Forest Service, a partnership that was built on our commitment to Southeast Alaska, through the creation of continuous year-round jobs. The commitment of the Forest Service was to provide us, through our partnership agreement, with 8.25 billion board feet of timber over 50 years at economical prices. KPC will continue to hold up its end of the partnership, and we're also investing in the future. Over the next 3 years, we'll invest between $60 to $70 million in our facility to get ahead of the environmental equation and the environmental curve, and that'll be through processes to better discharge our effluent through a marine outfall in Tongass Narrows, an attempt to create a TCF, a totally chlorine-free pulping process, and other pollution prevention measures. However, a partnership is a two-way street, and we can't continue to operate, or we can't operate on thin air. We require a predictable, certain, and economically priced supply of timber, and I think you heard that from the earlier panel. The same situation is true with independents. For the first 35 years of our partnership with the Forest Service, they met their end of the bargain. But over the last 5 years, the Forest Service has failed to uphold their part of the agreement. And I want to key on 3 trends here today. That only two of the last 6 years has the Forest Service met the minimum contract volume that Ketchikan Pulp is due. The amount of timber under contract to Ketchikan Pulp has plummeted dramatically, leaving us no flexibility. And third, the timber offerings that the KPC has gotten, and I'll elaborate on this further, have become later and later in the year, and to the point that they come at the end of the operating season and effectively delay us accessing that timber for another 6 to 12 months as we build road and other things that we have to do to prepare to harvest that timber. I want to make it very clear. KPC has not asked, is not here today, and will not ask for any more than is asked for in our partnership agreement. All we ask is that they meet the agreements that we've made in the past. I have some charts that I'll use today. And the first one I want to do is, we talk a lot about our contract and our partnership agreement with the Forest Service. There's three very important controlling numbers. One is 8.25 billion board feet. That's the amount of timber that the Forest Service and our partnership agreement is to give us over a 50-year contract that expires in the year 2004. 192.5 million board feet. That's the average annual offering at a minimum that they are supposed to provide Ketchikan Pulp Company. The 225 million board feet, effective January 1st of 1995, is the amount of volume they would have to give us every year to reach their final contract commitment of the 8.25 at the end of 50 years. Those are the important numbers. Those are the controlling numbers of the contract, especially the top one, and those are the facts. Unfortunately, I want to share with you the Forest Service's accomplishments over the last 6 years, starting in 1999. As you can see, in only two of the last 6 years have they met the contract volume that they're to offer us, that 192.5, that minimum, which is denoted by this line. Here's the 225 line. So you can see that we have reason to be skeptical in the future, especially when you see years like 1993 that has put us in the present hole that we have. I want you to remember, of this 176 million board feet we got last year, Ketchikan Pulp was only actually able to harvest approximately 110 million board feet, and that's because a large, significant part of this offering came at the end of the year, came in September. And you know what happens not too long after September? It snows, and you can't build road and you can't harvest timber, and that's what's put us in one of the crunches that we have today. And I'll elaborate on those further. But the delays in Forest Service offerings have given us absolutely no flexibility to plan our operations, to keep our people working, and to keep that pipeline, or what we call the timber pipeline, full and our people working. And unfortunately, the current sale program the Forest Service has given us for this year continues to decrease in the amount of volume that they talk about offering us. And the sales that we are offering, they keep getting later and later in the timber sale program. Some of them they said they were going to give us in March or now in May. You know, we start losing a couple months, and a large part of the volume that we will get in 1995 will once again be in September and October, when it's too late to go out and harvest it or to begin building roads and keep our mills operating. And I want to show you a couple reasons why having a timber pipeline, having extra timber in the pipeline so we have flexibility, and why we need to get our timber sale offerings earlier in the year. One of them is building roads. And I think you can see that in 1989, we had to build 0.37 miles of road, about a third of a mile of road, for each million board feet that we harvested from the Forest Service. By the end of last year, through last year, we're now up to almost 0.75 miles of road. It takes longer to get to access the timber that we have to get, and where it used to take us maybe a year to get all the roads in, and now it takes us 2 years to get all the roads in. And that's why you have to have flexibility built in. That's why we need our timber sale offerings earlier. The other one is timing restrictions. And what I have here is a graph that shows some typical timing restrictions that you can see on some timber sales. The red area shows the times where our operations are curtailed for varying reasons. We may not be able to build road. We may not be able to build ridges or bridges. Or we may not be able to actually harvest timber. But I think you can see that if you lap all these over, we have things like goat winter range and goat kidding restrictions and swan restrictions, wolf den restrictions, that critter that we're not going to list now as an endangered species. Eagles, different depending on what size of fish, whether the adults are in there or the young ones or the medium-sized ones are in there, determine what we can do. But you can see the only free window that you have starts in September. Again, that shoves us into the problem of not being able to build roads and causes that flexibility problem. We work with the Forest Service to try to find ways to meet the intent of the timing restrictions, protect those resources that are out there, and still do some operations. We've been successful in some cases. We've been unsuccessful in others. But it's those kinds of timing restrictions which are making it very hard to get timber to our mills. The bottom line for this community is simple. Because of the lack of timber that we've gotten from the Forest Service, the deficiency that's within the timber sale pipeline and the timing of those timber sales, we have people out of jobs. We currently have our Ketchikan sawmill at Ward Cove is currently down due to lack of timber. We currently have most of our production at our Annette Hemlock Mill at Metlakatla down, and we are currently scrambling to find enough wood to work us through April at our pulp mill so we don't have to have a temporary extended shutdown there. And in addition, our of even more concern from a safety standpoint, I think you know our industry gets looked at from the safety standpoint, we find our times many times because of the late offerings and others shutting down our operations for safety reasons when our mills are starving for timber and those people also lose their jobs. In 1993, Ketchikan Pulp Mill shut down for 100 plus days due to a lack of timber volume. In 1994, a shutdown did not have to happen. But the reason that was is we were lucky enough to get some of the pulp volume from the old APC contract that was terminated by the Clinton administration. That doesn't exist anymore, and that causes us even more concern for 1995. In addition, the leaders of the Forest Service are now taking steps to limit timber supply even further through habitat conservation areas. While there's no final decision to be made, they've still implemented those HCA guidelines, taking over 400 million board feet of timber off the market that could have been offered to us, could have kept our facilities open, could have kept that panel that was here before you, their operations running. And they developed an illegal plan and haven't followed the law, and they're implementing it at this time, even though they haven't made a decision. And to make it worse, they've made it on bad science. The science is very, very weak for the idea of habitat conservation areas. And basically, when we talk about habitat conservation areas, we're talking about goshawks and martens, if you follow the readings of what's called the Viable Population Committee, the VIPOP Committee, or VPOP Committee. And so that's what we focus on. When you look at the current assessment of goshawks being done by the Forest Service, they're showing that almost none of the telemetry points, the radio points that they, when they track the birds, none of those are showing up in what we call interior productive old growth. Instead, as I would expect, they're predominantly found around the edges of openings created by clear cutting as the goshawk tries to find food. And in addition, the draft plan amendment EA map for the HCAs, the Forest Service proposal, shows that only 3% of the located goshawk nests fall within their HCA system. The other ones are outside of it. Does the goshawk need large tracts of old growth? I'd say the indications are no. Marten are an introduced species to southeast Alaska. Hence, there is no obligation by the Forest Service to manage for them. The National Forest Management Act, which I'm sure the Forest Service may refer to, and its implementing regulations call for ensuring habitat to have viable populations of native and desired non-native species. There are numerous natives in southeast Alaska that suggest the marten may be hurting the ptarmigan and grouse populations, species that they find important. The bottom line is the so-called evidence to support HCAs, regardless of how they've been developed illegally, the strategy to ensure viable populations is crumbling beneath the Forest Service's feet, and their hypothesis has been shown to be false. There's no evidence that we need to take an additional 21% of timber out of the Tongass timber base. HCIs aren't the only problems. We also have goshawk guidelines. The HCA plan amendment calls for 8.4-mile circles around goshawk nests with no harvest within those within what they call the 95% of the harmonic mean of the telemetry areas. A 1994 goshawk workshop talked about having 2.9-mile radiuses around those goshawk nests with no timber harvest. The current assessment underway by the Forest Service shows that, as I said before, few of those points fall within old growth. And we're also finding goshawk nests, and there have been, in the past, active goshawk nests found on Douglas Island near downtown Douglas, not too far from the state capitol. The bottom line is there's no scientific evidence that large tracts of land need to be set aside for the protection of the goshawk. The only logical choice is for Regional Forester Janik to select the no-action alternative in implementing HCAs, a decision that we expect soon. As I said before, currently 400 million board feet of what we call NEPA-approved has been through all the appeals process, and Senator Stevens has and the rest of the congressional delegation has worked hard to get the Forest Service extra money to get this timber into the pipeline, is held up because of their HCA proposal. Even if the Forest Service agreed there was no supporting evidence for HCAs and goshawks, they'd point the finger at conservation biology or conserving biodiversity. They'd also point the finger at the peer review of the VPOP report that was done a year ago as evidence that we need to do more to protect viable populations and biodiversity. As you hear people talk about the VPOP committee, I want you to remember that this group of scientists, only two of, I believe there was 15 on the group, but only two of them had visited Southeast Alaska. There was conversation about the Southeast Alaska caribou and tundra on the Tongass National Forest. I think that puts their peer review in suspect. Common sense needs to be brought into the process. There's too much agenda science, scientists with agenda, and that's the science that we've heard from the VPOP committee and the peer review scientists that they use to do that. HCAs are based on the president's plan for the Pacific Northwest to lock up more timber on the Tongass National Forest. And I want you to remember as we talk about this today that the 1979 Tongass Land Management Plan, as amended by the Tongass Timber Reform Act, 38% of the productive old growth is in congressional withdrawals. Of the 3.4 million acres of productive old growth outside of congressional withdrawals, only 1.94 is suitable to consider for timber harvest. Hence, there's 1.2 million acres that won't be harvested of that 3.1. Hence, about 63% of the productive old growth on the Tongass National Forest will never be logged. I suggest that based on common sense, protecting 63% of the old growth on the Tongass is ample to meet the implementing regulations of the National Forest Management Act to protect viable populations of wildlife species and to meet the Endangered Species Act. We believe that that's balance. And I'd suggest that the American public voted out the kind of nonsense that we talk about in HCAs on November 8th. I want you, a lot of people talk about whether the Tongass is overcut. I have two other graphs that I'll share with you. One is the top line, this blue line, is the sustainable level of harvest that could be cut off the forested lands, the suitable timberlands on the Tongass National Forest. Here over time, here's 1954 when the pulp mill was started, Ketchikan pulp mill, and you can see what was harvested. The red line is the total Tongass harvest. The green line is the volume that's been harvested by Ketchikan Pulp Corporation. So you can see both those lines are well below the sustainable level.
What is that level, the top, the blue line, what is that level?
It's right at a billion board feet. I didn't put the numbers on this side because it got a little messy. But I can get those for you, Representative. The other one is the percent of, and this is forested land on the Tongass that's been harvested. As you can see, in 1952, 0.2% of the Tongass had been harvested. By 1972, it was 2% of the Tongass has been harvested. And by 1992, 3.6% of the Tongass has been harvested. The scare tactics of other groups that the Tongass is being over-harvested, that we're cutting all the trees, is not true. And it's factually incorrect. So I want to leave that with you today. The bottom line is that Ketchikan Pulp wants to stay in this community and continue to be a productive part of it, but we need your help and the help of our congressional delegation in breaking the gridlock of overlapping environmental laws and frivolous lawsuits that are filed by preservationist groups. I sincerely want to thank you for the time that you spend in Ketchikan today, and it's been a pleasure to have you here, and we look forward to answering questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reinhardt. We will have questions later in the program. Very informative. Next, we have the Grassroots Community Panel. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Robert E. Lindkugel, and I'm the Conservation Director for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. And SEAC, is, for your information, is a coalition of 15 volunteer citizen groups in 12 different communities here in Southeast, from Ketchikan all the way to Yakutat. In fact, one of our member groups here in Ketchikan, the Tongass Conservation Society, could not be with us here today, and some of their members have been kind enough to come here and help me out on our side of the panel here. SEAC is dedicated to preserving the integrity of the Southeast Alaska's unsurpassed national environment and providing for a sustainable economic future for all its industries. We understand that the purpose of this hearing is to consider what can be done to solve what the timber industry calls a timber supply issue. We believe, however, that the focus and format of this hearing procedure prevents the committee from understanding the complexity of the issues that confront users of the Tongass and the interests of all the users to this forest. We've heard about how much productive old growth is on the forest. However, only 15% of the entire forest has the medium and large trees that the industry wants to cut, the timber industry wants to cut, and that is also necessary to support the commercial fisheries and the wildlife for the hunting, subsistence, commercial fisheries, and tourism industries. The most endangered species on the Tongass are the workers and families who depend upon a healthy forest ecosystem. Not a lot of the Tongass has been cut, correct, but what has been cut is the most productive portion of the Tongass, okay, the heart of the Tongass. SEAC has invited representatives from the tourism, commercial, sport fishing, and small timber operators to speak to you so that you can understand the breadth of some of the issues here and the complexity of trying to address this and the need to bring all the parties together. Our first speaker is Dave Salee. He's got a long history here, and I'll pass it to you, Dave.
Yeah, thank you for being here this morning, and I appreciate being here, being able to do this. I'm Dave Salee. I'm an ex-logger. I was born here in 1941, and I've never left the country. This has been my homeland. It's been where I've stayed virtually all of my life, and I've made my living here, mostly as a logger, almost entirely, from the about the late 1950s up until about 1988. I was very active, had a small business operation of my own, an A-frame Kodak set up, and spent virtually all my working life up to this point logging. I'm not comfortable with the climate that we have here in this day and age, the way things are. It's too full of contention, and basically it has put me out of the picture. And not that I'm particularly selfish about that, it's just that I feel like one of the things that has happened is that the small people have been just, okay, you guys don't count anymore. And I'm not happy with that. I think I don't like the idea that what we're doing is a really kind of a skimpy manufacturing program in our timber industry. We cut stuff into cans, we cut stuff into baby squares, we make it into pulp, and we ship it overseas into other markets for remanufacture into finished products. And my point here that I really want to make is basically that we start doing a lot more manufacturing of our dwindling timber resources. And so this is where I come from. I want to see a lot more small putt-and-pop businesses. I want to see a lot more cabinet millwork little businesses, or they don't have to be totally little. They can be medium-sized or whatever. So that's where I come from, and I just want to give this statement so that you know that there is somebody interested from this particular point of view. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, gentlemen. My name is Jack Lee. I'm the past chairman of Tongass Sport Fishing Association, Chapter 573 of Trout Unlimited. Like our national organization, we actively promote fisheries conservation and enhancement and address issues that impact fisheries habitat and the recreation opportunities they offer. Unlike many fishing organizations, we have a fairly diverse membership, and our board of directors has seats for sport fishers, charter operators, lodge and related businesses, and agency representatives from Fish and Game and Forest Service. We view the value of the fisheries resource in terms of the $83 million spent on sport fishing statewide. $61 million of that was in the Southeast. This translates into over 1,100 full-time jobs, 950 of which are in Southeast. These are 1988 figures and have grown with the rapidly growing tourism industry that sport fishing is an important element of. Sport fishers, like loggers and others, are being impacted by legislation such as the Endangered Species Act. We may soon see cutbacks in our king salmon harvest limits because of the problems of returns down south. Do we like it? Is it fair? Should we do away with the Endangered Species Act and similar environmental laws? No to all points. It would be far better for us to learn from the mistakes of others and avoid the problems that made this legislation necessary. Wise resource management and habitat protection will assure a more prosperous future for everyone, regardless of the chosen profession. We are currently concerned with the local situation that illustrates this point. While steelhead returns have been alarmingly low for the past several years, the recent proposal by Senator Murkowski to allow the landless native tribes to select land in lead two areas could drastically increase the problem with steelhead returns. Lead two areas were given their protected status for their high recreation and habitat value. Many of these areas support runs of wild steelhead, and logging could push steelhead populations a step closer to threatened status. The point we want to make here is that it's time to take off the blinders and deal with the impacts of logging before they become problems. If we can't learn from watching the fiasco that has been going on with the timber industry in the Northwest, there isn't much hope for us. The Tongass Timber Reform Act and the establishment of lead two areas was a good first step. The establishment of habitat conservation areas will also help to avoid future problems. The timber industry must learn to coexist with fishing and tourism and their needs. To do this, you must learn to operate within the guidelines of recent reforms. Let's stop the finger-pointing, the name-calling, and work on realistic solutions. In the past, the timber industry has received assistance which helped them stay profitable. If we begin viewing habitat maintenance and a clean environment as part of the cost of doing business, perhaps we can come up with some solutions that we can all live with. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Dale Pillman. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to make comments to the committee this morning. First of all, I'm going to make comments personally about my business and on the management of the Tongass, and then also I'm presenting remarks on behalf of the Alaska Wilderness Recreation and Tourism Association that couldn't be here. And I'll make some summary comments of their text and include a more complete expanded text for your record. As I said, my name is Dale Pillman. I'm a native of Southeast Alaska, having been born and raised in Ketchikan. I've lived in Ketchikan all my life except for 7 years spent in Wrangell. I fished commercially for 20 years, primarily in Southeast Alaska, and worked for the state of Alaska for 5 years as a fisheries management biologist. Currently, I'm in the visitor industry. My wife and I own five tour vessels, which do scenic tours in the Ketchikan area and carry approximately 15,000 passengers a year. I'm vitally concerned about the overharvesting, that the overharvesting of our forest will have an adverse impact on our business in the not-too-distant future. Visitors are attracted to Alaska primarily because of its image as a land of scenic grandeur. However, as we remove old-growth timber, our area has less appeal. Old-growth timber is disappearing at an alarming rate. I own an airplane and spend a considerable amount of time flying around Southeast Alaska, so I have a good grasp of the rapidly changing landscape. I appreciate the opportunity to present testimony today. However, I can't help but notice a small amount of time allotted to the visitor industry versus the timber industry. This situation, I think, is indicative of the lack of appreciation for the economic contribution of tourism to the state's economy. For example, in 1993, the visitor industry created 15,200 jobs. The logging industry, only about 3,185 jobs. Visitors to Alaska spend $1.5 billion in contrast to the timber industry's contribution of $565 million to the economy. The payroll generated by the tourism industry generated a payroll between $275 and $300 million, while the timber industry produced a payroll of about $140 million. In summary, the visitor industry is between two and three times larger than the timber industry. Continuing clear-cut logging is adversely affecting the visitor industry. On my tours, I increasingly hear complaints about clear-cut logging. If we don't control excessive logging soon, Alaska will be tainted as a wilderness tour destination, and the appeal of a truly precious resource, wilderness, will be lost. Wilderness is a resource. and must be protected or the Alaska visitor industry will diminish in importance. I bear no animosity toward the timber industry. I and every member of my family have worked either in the timber industry and our support industry. I spent a considerable amount of time longshoring with Representative Williams, as a matter of fact, loading pulp and cans over the years, during my college years. I appreciate the frustration that the timber industry faces as the timber supply declines. However, it is starting to bear the brunt of years of high grading and overharvesting. Let's take action to reduce overharvesting before irreversible damage is done to Alaska's tourism industry. A few summary comments from the presentation of the Alaska Wilderness Recreation Tourism Association. Several points. Number one, economically, some good things are happening in Southeast Alaska. Between 1989 and 1993, tourism in Southeast Alaska increased 43%, providing more business and job opportunities. Two, ARTA is concerned about forest management practices that will adversely impact tourism businesses, especially those in the tourist recreation category that rely on natural resources of the Tongass. The current level of harvesting will displace existing businesses and reduce the land base available for recreation and tourism development. The landless native bill in Congress would adversely affect Southeast scenic quality and visitor satisfaction. Five, tourism contributes more to the state economy than the forest products industry. Six, the tourism industry needs relief from current high levels of timber cuts to avoid losing its market share in a domestic and global marketplace. Seven, the landless native bill illustrates the need to thoroughly evaluate the landless native issue and propose a comprehensive solution rather than proposed piecemeal approach. Eight, tourism companies should receive compensation for loss of natural resources. And finally, nine, public policy decisions that allocate federal and state resources and affect other industries should be made with the benefit of the full public input. Thank you very much for having the hearing here and for being allowed to testify.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's hard to say something that's not going to be said a number of different times, but I'm going to try. My name is Bruce Wallace. I'm a Ketchikan resident of 30 years. I've been a commercial fisherman for 25. I've worked in construction. I've worked in mining. I've worked at the pulp mill. And I think I reflect a little bit of what any long-term Southeast Alaska resident has done, a little bit of everything. My point, I guess, is from a commercial fishing perspective today. Understanding the focus of the meeting, I'd like to describe just one of the complications that any administrative decision will necessarily impact, and it's directly related to the question of long-term industry viability. The commercial fishing industry has little or no disagreement with most of the sentiments that have been voiced here this morning about that aspect. However, the complication is based in salmon. There are 2,900 cataloged by Alaska Department of Fish and Game salmon systems within Southeast Alaska. We made this presentation to the Pacific Salmon Commission. When you draw that map, it looks like a road map of New York City. I mean, almost every place there is a red line. If you were to expand those red lines to include the drainages and then do that overlay against the Forest Service maps, what you would find is salmon and therefore commercial fishing has a direct and ongoing relationship with the forests. That relationship complicates everything that is an administrative decision within the Forest Service or the public and private land sectors of the state controls. One of the things I did for 8 years was a member of the Board of Forestry. I understand those points well, and I do not profess to have a full solution, but whatever decisions are made must be made with that reflection of the complexity of interaction between fish and forest. That basic relationship reflects what is Southeast Alaska, both from the community and from the resource base. It has to be part of the solution. And I guess as a closing comment, one of the things I've realized in the Pacific Salmon Commission is that you have to have agreed database. And it sounds to me from a standoff position that that's one of the problems with where we're going on any solution right now. So maybe as an active role, the legislative people can direct that resolution of data. Because without agreed data, you won't get any active and long-term resolution of a problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Good morning, Chairman Williams, Speaker Phillips. I am happy to see that you folks were able to adjust your schedule to meet in Ketchikan. My name is Bill Thomas from Ketchikan. Some of you have exposure to another Bill Thomas, and I won't get into that. I wouldn't regard him any further than this if I were you. So, anyway, I'm here to give you some viewpoints from the area of subsistence in this whole scheme. Subsistence is probably the area that stands the greatest risk in all of this. In order for subsistence to survive anything, it's dependent upon good management, good stewardship, responsible usage. Subsistence, I think, is a good model for the use of any resource. You handle your natural resources like you handle your bank account, and you're liable to be comfortable for a lot longer than you would otherwise. We talk about sustaining the economy in Southeast Alaska and Alaska. At the same time, we hear about the demise of the economic struggles that occur in other parts of the country. Washington, Oregon, Northern California are good examples. The conditions that have become a failure for them down there brings them to the only place up here to salvage their livelihood. While we've been good stewards and good hosts, I don't know that we can continue to do that to every part of the lower 48 that runs into an economic problem. We've done that with the pipeline. We created a lot of jobs when the pipeline was built. When the pipeline was done, we lost a lot of population because they all went back to Texas, Louisiana, Florida. Well, I guess my point is that in our effort to be a good steward and to provide good economics for everybody that comes here seeking for relief from this, that it places a burden on the resources that we have available in Alaska. Those of you that have been in the legislature for any time at all have know what I mean. Now, those of you that are familiar with the different fisheries pressure from the high seas interception to the dragging of the Aleutian chain, the harvest of the king crab, and the bycatches, and it goes on and on. That's only one part of the resource. If we continue to manage our resources in that fashion, we will be in trouble. So I guess the point I'm going to say is I'm not going to speak to any issue of support and non-support, but I am committed to supporting those efforts I see that will go to preserve the availability and the maintenance of subsistence. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas.